Well, welcome back to another episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug. This is episode 91, and don't worry about the audio quality of this segment. I am recording this just on the fly in my hotel room in Middleton, Ireland. We've just weathered Tropical Storm Ophelia, and actually the power at the hotel didn't blip out for more than about 10 minutes total yesterday, but certainly there's lots of areas in and around County Cork, Middleton, and just this whole area around the harbor that are suffering power loss. People are, you know, without, actually some of the water utilities are also off because the water treatment plants have been shut off. So it's kind of still a bit of a mess here, but the storm did blow through yesterday. There were a couple of fatalities in the region, unfortunately, but and I saw some downed trees and whatnot today, and there was evidently like buildings damaged, as one might expect from a tropical storm that had only recently been a hurricane. But you know, for the most part, this area seems to have weathered it. Life seems to be back to normal. I'm recording this on a Tuesday evening. Although, by the time most of you listen to it, it's going to be more like, I don't know, Tuesday afternoon, roughly. And again, don't worry about the audio quality here. I landed in Ireland. My luggage did not. So, unfortunately, or, you know, fortunately, I did bring along some recording gear, but it's the Rode VideoMic Me, it's my iPhone, and that's what I'm recording on right now. So that's why this segment is going to have a little bit of a dip in audio quality. But the next segment, that we're going to launch into and end with, will have just fine audio quality. And as you might have hoped, it is the second part of our interview with Raf Koster, which was recorded. It was recorded a while ago, admittedly. But you know what? I've dropped Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug to a roughly every 2 weeks publishing schedule just because that's what I can maintain right now. So, as always, this episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug is brought to you by our Patreon backers. Thank you to everyone who supports the podcast and the Codex by that means. And as always, a big hearty thank you to our co-producers, Seth, Dominic, Chris, Violation, Adam, Eric, Thorwan, Pascal, Helgriff, Aaron, the Hearth of Britannia, Edward, Stirring Dragon, and Cranberry. Like I said, this week we're continuing the interview with Raf Koster, and I don't see any point in keeping you waiting for that any longer, so here goes.
Yeah, there are many, many more stories like these.
So, do you have more time? You've got dinner next to you, so it's possible that you'd like to run. But if you've got more time and more stories, then
it's cold already. How about you guys ask some questions again, and then we'll.
I have a question.
Yeah, we'll give it a few questions, and then I should go.
Yeah, Golden Flame. Did you have something you wanted to bring up? You
started. There was a thing that WTF put into the chat that he wanted asked about, and we'll get to it if we get to it. And but yeah, if I ask yours now, so it's more natural part of the flow.
Okay, all right. So mine's, I don't know, maybe not long, but maybe it'll come out to be a long thing anyway. I wanted to know the Easter eggs and the rares. I mean, how were any of those contrived, or did they occur more naturally?
So there are more Easter eggs that people still haven't even twigged to, I think, funny enough. One that I realized that people had not found, and I'm going to spoil it now, is, you know, the Tillerman stories. I wrote all the Tillerman stories. I understand that they actually were inactive for a very long time. But that they got turned back on a while back. For some reason, they stopped working and they came back. One of the Tillerman stories that he tells is actually the plot to a specific Edgar Allan Poe story. And I've never seen anybody notice comment on that, but I dropped that in as a random little reference. So many of the things were intentional, in particular things like occasionally spawning a llama instead of an energy vortex, right? That was absolutely us. We did that.
That was great.
Yeah, the Vorpal Rabbit was in there, of course. We did that. The Johnny Wilson slime was absolutely us. That was after we got Coaster of the Year from Computer Gaming World. We were so mad that we made one of the slimes spawn occasionally with the name Jay Wilson. So Yeah. Not I was, proud
I
of
was
that.
Always nice. Bewildered by that because it was in the data files that somebody had made for POL. They had just gone through and put all of the monsters in. And so that one's in there. And I just was always very confused by it until a couple of years later, I finally actually heard the story from Richard.
So I actually cornered Johnny at some point. And he said, "Are you kidding me? I'm a huge fan of Ultimas," which he was. The fact that I made it into an Ultima game, I consider it an honor, although I wish I hadn't been a slime. And I said, "Well, to be fair, do you think you were wrong? I mean, at this point, at this point it was years later." I said, "This point is pretty clear. It was a massive, monumental landmark of a game." And he said, "Yes, and it launched completely broken and buggy as hell, and you know it." So I said, "Fair enough," and we parted as friends. Absolutely, a bunch of those things were intentional, right? I mean, there were plenty of things that we tucked away like that all through the game. There were also things that were bugs, and we would leave them in rather than try to fight it. So True Black Dye was one of those, right? True black occurred because in the hue system, a hue is basically a color palette, right? It's an array of colors. And normally it's supposed to, like, the color black, the hue black, actually went from a really dark gray up through lighter grays for highlights, right? So that was the darkest black that was available. But if you basically managed to send null for a hue, you got an uninitialized palette that had absolute true black in every slot in the palette, which meant, you know, the sprite had no highlights to it, no shadows and highlights. That is what true black dye was. And it was probably somebody with a packet hacker or some similar tool who managed to initialize a dye tub to null. That created the first true black dye. It's also possible that there was a bug in the dye spawning system, the dye tub spawner system. We randomized what colors dye tubs appeared with in the game, you know, which hue the index they used. If that didn't check for index zero or out of rage indices, it's possible that it could have spawned true black. Once that, you know, took over the game because everybody went absolutely apeshit for it. The artists desperately wanted us to patch it out of the game. They're like, "It's horrendous looking. It looks like a hole in the screen. It's awful. Take it out." But it was so popular. People were eBaying it. People were murdering one another for it. We ended up making the gameplay decision to leave it in. Let it just be a rare color.
And then I guess later on you did rainbow or something as well?
Rainbow ice was also, you know, when you got the ice dragons and whatnot, that was when literally I took one of the hues and I said, "What if I run the color ramp in the other direction?" Which is, of course, what ice kind of looks like. That is how you got all the ice creatures. They're just the color ramps run in reverse.
And then, of course, there were the not locked down water tiles, stuff like that. The rares, yes, that people would stick in their houses.
Yeah. So when people say, "Oh, too bad you took out the resource system," I don't think people realize how much of the resource system is still there. Right. The reason why you can fish in a water tile is because an individual dynamic tile produces a given amount of water. And the fishing script checks to see if the tile that is targeted produces water. Right? I mean, things like that are part of the underlying simulation, right? All of the crafting stuff still uses the resource. When you migrate, when you make a meat pie, you are transferring meat resource from the, you know, the cow onto a fillet, into the steak, into the pie, right? That's how that still works behind the scenes. It's not standardized crafting recipe. So that is why so many of those things, like the picking up water tiles, ended up working. The reason why there were dynamic water tiles anyway is because here's something else we ran out of time to do. Originally, the entire ocean was supposed to be like the second floor of a house. You may have noticed that along the coastlines, there the water there is actually like roof tiles or second floor tiles floating above the ground. And there is a trench running along the entire coastline of the game.
Right. Yep.
Yep.
Originally, that trench was the seabed, and the entire surface of the game, of the ocean, was supposed to be tiles like that, and they were supposed to be translucent, and we had a whole array of sea creatures planned that would run around underneath that water roof and sometimes surface. And that is why you can see sometimes in some of the art, you might find sea serpents and whatnot that have partially obscured translucent bottoms and visible tops and stuff like that. Originally, we were going to let fish loose under the water and have them run around under the water. And we even talked about letting players jump under the water with water breathing and walk around on the bottom of the ocean underneath the water.
That and would be cool.
We ran out of time to do any of that.
It's very un-Ultima, though. Obviously, touching water immediately kills avatars. We know that from
Ultima. Sure. So when we realized we couldn't do that, we ended up doing deep water and shallow water. And the plan was, we're like, but we made fish. We made sea serpents. We made dolphins. You know, where are we going to put them? So we made all the deep water be terrain and set it at sea level and made it dead flat. And then we took the trenches and I made a set of color ramp seabed textures, right? Those, I now recall those were me too, which is why if you look at a source data map and you look at just the terrain tiles, you'll see that they basically have this like mud brown gradient in those trenches. That was to provide the fade. And we put translucent water tiles placed with flood fill and by hand all the way around the entire map. Yeah. And the plan was we would let the dolphins and fish loose in those trenches since we couldn't let them loose everywhere. And then it turned out we had to cut the underwater creatures, so we didn't get to put any critters in the trenches at all. But the trench is still there, and it has a water roof. The water roof is made out of objects rather than terrain tiles. When you go to place something in UO, you have to specify whether or not it is a static object, meaning it will ship on the CD, or it's a dynamic object, meaning it's server simulated, can run scripts, can be manipulated, and whatnot. If you want anything to be interactive, it had to be dynamic. You had to, basically, you had in the God tool, you had a checkbox, place things as static, place things as dynamic. It was a mode you had to toggle. And you had show dynamic objects toggle that you could turn to show them as translucent or not. And one of the commonest things that would make a map builder get up and say, God damn it, I'm taking the rest of the afternoon off and I'm going to Amy's for ice cream to drown my sorrows, would be that you would build something like a city, for example. You'd be working on a city for 4 hours and realize that after putting down all of the candelabras that you needed to be dynamic so that they could be lit and unlit, you forgot to flip the toggle back and proceeded to build buildings and benches and trees as dynamic and had forgotten to mark them as locked down. And you'd end up having built half of Trinzik out of walls that people could pick up and put in their backpack. So we went through and tried to catch as many of these. It was a very easy mistake to make. But water tiles in somebody's backpack and all the other rares in the game were cases where somebody missed one. And players obsessively moused over every single tile in the game.
We sure did.
Oh, of course they did.
So they picked up, they found a place where there was one piece of a pond, one of those roof water tiles, right, meant to go over a trench. They picked up a piece of the ocean, and that is how that started.
My favorite thing about that, that was one of the things that made me feel the most like I was back out of mud, because my understanding is that a new one of those will appear the next time the server restarts.
That was our hack patch.
And that was on the mud that I used to play on in college. There, and I think a lot of muds did this. I do not know if Legend did, but there were a lot of items that would spawn when the server started, but then never again. And so there would be a race every time the server starts of people running their Tintin macros.
Yes, indeed.
To try to blitz, and like individual people would become known as, okay, I was the person who got the blue scroll or whatever. So finding that race happening again in UO was something that really tied it back to its mud roots for me.
So, yeah. So the answer is it was completely unintentional. Our respawning of the dynamic objects was our hack for the fact that players were scavenging everything. When we started out, we actually said, you know, like the plates on the tables, those should be manipulable. You should be able to sit down, go into a house. If it's got a turkey on the table, you should be able to eat it, and then we'll respawn it. Players instead just looted everything dry. So we had to go back through and lock all of those down, and we missed some.
I have a story from my graveyard on that kind of stuff. It was a birthday party, and the person who was throwing the party had his house open and had a chest, and in that chest he had enough cake for all the attendants. And there was this 12-year-old kid, and he entered the house, and he saw the cake, and he took all of them. So when the party started, there was no cake.
Yeah, that's why we ended up having to make it so that all of these things came back whenever the server rebooted. We couldn't make them locked down because that required them to be patched. We couldn't make them static. That would have required them to be patched to the CD. So we tried patching as many as we could. But after a while, we saw the excitement there was around the rares market. And, you know, at this point, I was running design. I just said, leave it. It's a game system now. So we did.
I think that was the right call.
Yep. And you basically single-handedly created an entire genre affecting MMOs everywhere.
Well, more than that, I've told this story before too, but, you know, first you had the rares market, and shortly after, because it took a little while for people to be able to afford, you got the eBay real estate market. Uh-huh. The first time I remember, it went around the office like a lightning bolt that a house was up on eBay selling for $1,000. And we had a big debate. And again, the debate ended up with, wow, this is absolute concrete proof that players love this frickin' game. That's cool. So, you know, we thought about trying to prevent it or stop it and ended up saying, there's no way we can make this not happen. So we decided to basically turn a blind eye to that eBay market. And I actually ended up using the price of gold on eBay. I would visit eBay every day and look at the exchange rate and use it to check whether or not the game had developed any dupe bugs. Because it, you know, obviously the value of gold would plummet on the open market if there were a dupe bug. I knew we'd eradicated it when UO Gold became stable at 400 GP to the dollar, and it stayed that way for a full year. I was like, we're in a good place. The economy is currently running in a balance, right? But of course, people then started gold farming, And that started out with them hiring workers in Tijuana out of the maquiladores, the textile factories there. And at first they did it that way, right? That was how it expanded out gradually. Started people did it, you know, on their own. Then they started hiring workers outside of the country. And then they said, oh, China is actually cheaper. Let's outsource to China. And that started creating the Chinese gold farmer. But the idea that these objects had real world value started inspiring people. Among the people who were inspired were Matt Mihaly, who ran the Iron Realms games, such as the Mud Achaea, Daniel James, who had run Avalon Mud, and then went on to do Puzzle Pirates. Those two guys domestically started pioneering the idea of cutting out the gold farmer, basically disintermediating the market. And in China, at the time, there wasn't a technology market. So the games were coming from Korea, right? China actually ended up putting in policies to even block Korean MMOs from China because they wanted to build their own domestic game development market. But back then, you know, as you know, Lineage, Dark Ages and whatnot were the games that were Kingdom of the Winds. Those were the games they were coming out of Korea. Those were the games that were being played in China as well as UO. And the folks in Korea already had far, far better internet connectivity than we did in the States or anybody in Europe, and were running into all kinds of social developments early, like PC Bangs, the internet cafe, right? Where people would go in and play as a guild taking over an internet cafe, stuff like that. And that's why in Korea, we started seeing an explosion of new kinds of MMOs. Like there was Audition, which was a rhythm dancing MMO. There was a basketball MMO. And of course, there was, because Korea didn't have consoles, because Japan, Korea, long history, electronics embargoes, whatever, Japanese consoles did not make it to the market in South Korea. It meant all of the gaming was PC gaming, but local developers said there are all these great console games that don't exist. If we clone them onto the PC, that sounds like a great business model. So somebody decided to clone Mario Kart and created a game called Kart Rider. And you guys probably know Kart Rider. When they're casting about for a business model for what are now effectively console games as MMO games, you know, disintermediating and directly selling in-game goods instead of having eBay do it seemed like a very logical business model. So I think there's a line to be traced from our screwing up water tiles and the birth of the free-to-play market.
I think that's a reasonable conclusion to come to.
It would have happened anyway, right? Because,
of course,
I mean, it did happen anyway, right? Collusion. But yeah, eBay was a relatively new thing, right, too. So it required all of those things to exist at once. And, you know, the UO Rares market and the idea that you could sell rare objects became one of those catalysts.
And I remember at the time a lot of debate behind the scenes from designers Mud Dev or whatever. Was it Entropia? Something like that?
That the one? Project Entropia, which is still running, by the way.
Yeah, I just pulled it up on Wikipedia. It's Entropia Universe now, I guess.
Yes,
right. But I remember when that was going out and was one of the first ones that was going to do the disintermediation, like you say, and just be like, we're just going to let people buy and sell through us directly. And the discussion of the moral responsibility behind that kind of thing, given that the games are already Skinner boxes to a certain extent, is it, you know, ethical to add that additional product? Yeah.
It was one of the huge gulfs, actually, between UO and Origin and games like EverQuest was that UO said third-party tools, we'll create a program for that. You're selling stuff on eBay? Okay, that's just part of the game. It's emergent player behavior, right? As well as, of course, player killing. Oh, you're forming governments and having naked armies to f- marauding bands of psychopaths? Okay, that's emergent player behavior, right? Whereas the other games were not interested in that kind of emergent player behavior. And so Sony Online actually took a very hard line against third-party tools and eBaying. And it was one of the differentiators. But that was the thing. UO was, I actually got in trouble for saying this to a reporter, that UO was a grand social experiment. And I got in trouble for saying it because the UO lawsuit was going on at the time. And the lawyer called me and said, do you realize we're being sued and you just called this an experiment that we are charging money for?
Oops.
You know, when we had behaviors in the game that were things that we had not fully expected, the UO instinct that was ingrained into the philosophy of the game was not, how do we block this or prevent it? It was, how do we add something else to the game to shape this behavior into a net positive? That was the approach. So when it turned out that players could use carpentry to build infinite dressers to block all the exits of the city of Trinzik, so that they could only get out through the one tile wide smuggler's gate back by the water where you had no visibility and therefore could be PK'd in an ambush, the response wasn't, let's disallow dropping objects. It was, from now on, you can chop up furniture that you find on the ground with an axe, right? It was always, how do we extend the simulation? Because the belief was, if there's an exploit, it's because our simulation isn't good enough yet.
And all this concept actually extended out to the Gray Shards as well. It's what's become legend is that the there are six developers who actually reverse engineered Ultima, the server side. And I have to say that I was not one of them, but I was like kind of involved in that group at a community level. And they were approached by EA and said, look, we could shut you down. But what we've decided to do is just basically let you do what you're doing as long as you promise to make sure that nobody charges for it.
Yeah, that wasn't EA. That was Gordon. That was us making that decision on the UO team.
Cool.
That was always the thing. When I was working with POL and eventually got to the point where I was project leading POL for the brief time that I was, just the flame wars, when we found out like there was a shard running POL in South Africa that was charging, and we were like, this could bring everything down, but we can't think of a possible way to stop it, so we're just gonna have to like try to shame him a lot, which didn't work.
Yeah, that's in MUDs, famously the Deku MUD license stated that you could not, that you had to always keep the credits of the original five creators of Deku MUD on the title screen, and you could never charge, right? And it was a huge deal and a public shaming thing if a MUD removed those names and if they started to charge. Even things like, we're not charging for play, we are charging in order to defray the volunteer costs or the server hosts, right? You had to, you know, the culture was that you had to say something like, we're going to do a fundraising drive for server costs, but the game is free, right? Because that was part of the Deku license. And that was actually, it's almost a forgotten footnote today, but EverQuest was so directly inspired by Deku MUDs that there was actually, like, even some of the text messages were the same, right? Like, when EverQuest launched, when it began to rain, it said, it begins to rain in the chat box. So a lot of Mudders thought that EverQuest was using Deku Mud code on the back end, which it was not. But Brad and the other guys ended up having to write a sworn statement stating that that was not the case. And it was a bit of a thing in the Mud community. So that culture, you know, that was the culture that we had been coming out of, right? If we had been in the single player game world, maybe we would have said it's piracy, right? But instead, we came out of the Mud world and we said players are running their own servers and they still have to buy the box.
Right.
Hell, why not? Yep. Less work for us because, you know, it's true.
We wouldn't get bandwidth.
Right. And not using our bandwidth costs, not using our customer support, they still have to buy the client. Right.
Of course, you still did keep us busy almost on a monthly basis, changing the encryption stream on the client.
Oh, God.
Yeah, because there was a period there, you know, done. Right. It wasn't like everybody said, OK,
right,
the encryption stuff was less for fighting. It was less for fighting the gray shards. That was about fighting the hack tools.
Right. The dupes and stuff.
ULE and stuff.
Yeah, the dupes and, you know, Dr. Twister and whatnot, who just sent me a Facebook message not long ago. Just a couple days ago. He was like, oh, wow. This brought me, hit me right in the feels, you know, kind of thing. I'm like, yeah, we never knew what to make of you, man. A lot of people use Dr. Twister tools in order to cheat early on.
Do you have a favorite bug or favorite bug story besides the ones that created the rares? There's one that a friend of mine who used to be a community person at UO told me that is, I think, after your time, so theoretically possible that you haven't heard about this one, but there was a dungeon where there was a box somewhere down in the dungeon that was supposed to just kind of float over, you know, one or two pixels up from the floor. And they started getting complaints that this thing was like 30 pixels up and none of the players could no longer reach it. And they tore the code apart trying to figure out what was going on. And eventually they figured out that the way they had implemented the float was that the object was on the ground. And when the server started, its Z would increment by one.
Right.
And so every time the server started, it got higher until frequently they would, you know, manually reset it and say, we don't see why this is happening. So maybe this will fix it.
Not after my time. I remember that.
All right.
I'd forgotten about that. I mean, early on, some of the bugs that were most one of the first ones, I don't remember if it may have been in the alpha. Windows in UO used to allow line of sight, which was a problem because it meant that anybody in a building, you couldn't target them because you couldn't click on them because you couldn't see them. But if they were inside the building, they could look out and they could shoot arrows at you through the windows and through the castle arrow slits. So we successfully managed to recreate the functionality of murder holes and arrow slits. Unfortunately, players used it on the newbie inn. Like they would spawn into the newbie inn, the clueless would walk out the door and get shot through the window by the people who stayed inside the inn. Not really a bug, but again, so that is why the windows are no longer openable, so to speak. So that one was annoying, and that was one of the first places where we had to compromise the simulation really early on. Gosh, other favorite bugs. There's so many bugs. The house stuff, you know, house break-ins was a huge pain. The roofs on UO are an optical illusion, right?
That's because right.
We couldn't actually do limitation of the tech. We couldn't actually do a solid sloping roof. It took us massive effort to figure out a way to do a sloping roof at all. But that is why you could fall through sloping roofs. So when players started stacking chairs up to infinity, and of course, we didn't have a physics system. Players stacked chairs up to infinity, but my favorite one was that a player figured out that you didn't need to just stack chairs indefinitely. Instead, you could make a chair, stand on it. Sorry, make a chair, make a second chair, set it on top of the first one, stand on the upper chair, pick up the lower chair, stack it on the second one, which is now floating in the air, right? And just use two chairs to leapfrog your way up into the sky. And from there, walk onto the roof of a house, fall inside, loot it dry, and walk out the door. That was a good one. And the frustrating thing was that we couldn't afford to make every object run a little script to check gravity. Because if we could have, we could have made the chair fall to the ground when you pulled out whatever was underneath it. And I think instead we ended up disallowing a bunches of ways of stacking things, which made me sad. It would have been nice to just implant gravity instead.
Is that also what led to the permission system and lockdowns within houses?
Eventually, yes. We couldn't figure out ways to keep people out of houses. We just kept trying and could not figure out a way. For a while, I don't remember if this ever it may have actually made it at one point. For a while, if you broke into somebody's house, door locks worked both ways and you couldn't get back out. So you try to break into a house and you'd be trapped inside. And then our fix for that was, okay, you can always walk out. You need the key to walk in. And then that resulted in, of course, people looting the houses. So, yeah, it was one of those things where we're just always racing to outsmart what the next emergent player trick would be. Rep system stuff and all the edge cases around turning red and turning gray was a never-ending madhouse. I mean, just ridiculous. And of course it led to people just, you know, that was our try at solving player killing. We tried multiple systems on it. At first it was bounties, and then bounties became a high score table for player killers and actually incentivized more player killing. So those had to go. So then we put in the rep system, and it didn't check enough different things. So pretty quickly, you had the people with the bad reputations turned out to be the people who were trying to do good, because the best reputation people were the exploiters who'd figured out ways to macro the reputation away. We tried criminal flagging, and we couldn't catch all the edge cases, like healing or passing somebody a healing scroll. So it's like, do you become criminal for engaging in trade? What about for dropping a healing scroll next to a player killer who's engaged in killing somebody? If they pick up an object you just dropped, were you helping them? You get the idea. Just this never-ending row of edge cases, which is why later games just said, there's a PK switch and you can't drop shit on the ground, right? Which... yeah. You know, dropping shit on the ground was like a fundamental. You know, you talk to some of the older virtual world developers like Randy Farmer, and they'll say the sign of whether or not it's a real virtual world is whether you can drop something on the ground. If you can't, then I know it's not really a persistent world, right? The irony is that, you know, we eventually did land on a flagging system in Galaxies that worked all right. But PK switch stuff was so firmly ingrained in everybody. You know, EverQuest launched and you couldn't get ganked randomly. That was a huge factor in them pulling away so many players, right? I think the first person 3D was another huge factor. But player killing was a massive, massive issue. It cost us half, two-thirds of the players who came through the game. It was a huge thing. And that was why Trammel happened. Right. That's right. Why the player base of UO basically doubled when Trammel happened. And I had been working so hard. I tried so many ways to avoid taking us to the point of safe zones. But Dark Age of Camelot came out with Realm versus Realm Combat, which is effectively safe zones. EQ came out with effectively safe zones. By the time World of Warcraft came out, it actually was what would have been called a free-for-all PvP game. It was an RVR game with criminal flags. And I'm like, you're using flagging! Oh my god! But they had such a different world architecture where the different sides weren't anywhere near one another when they started, right? So the odds of being ganked were so dramatically lower that people didn't think of WoW as a PvP game at first. And so the systems that hadn't worked when everybody was piled up in close proximity did work when you layered them on top of a realm versus realm kind of structure. So yeah, so many bugs, so many. I'm not sure I can pick favorite. I warned you as long-winded, didn't I?
It's like picking between your children.
Yeah.
So,
had left this question in mainline ult.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to hit back on. You have a dragon name. I don't remember whether that's because you had to play stuff when you started working on UO or were already a fan of the Ultima series.
I had played and beaten Ultima 3 back on 8-bit computers.
The best version of Ultima, I believe, ever.
Really? Wow, that's a controversial choice.
I know.
Most people choose 4 or 7.
Right. Well,
WTF will say 6, so I'll toss that out here while he's not here.
Yeah, so I had an Atari 8-bit.
Too, but...
Yeah, I had an Atari 8-bit, so I played Ultima 1 through 3. And I beat 3. I never did beat 1 or 2. Spaceship combat just completely defeated me in Ultima 1. Oh my god. Because I went straight from 8-bit Atari computers, you know, the contemporaries of Apples and Commodores, to Macintoshes. And so I was not a PC gamer for quite a period of time there. I was doing MUDs and online games and whatnot. We didn't own a PC. So when I went to work at Origin, it wasn't till then that I eventually said, well, crap, I need to buy a PC at home. I got to tell you, 1996 was a pretty good year to start PC gaming. Because 96, 97, 98 were like a pinnacle for PC gaming, right? Total Annihilation, Fallout, Quake, Half-Life. It was a really good couple of years anyway.
Right.
But yeah, we had been on Macintoshes. And so that was fine when we were doing MUD work, right? It didn't matter. But that meant that I had missed from Ultima 7 through Ultima 8. I had not played them. When I got to Origin, I don't even remember what the process was, but I did join the Dragons and grab the designer dragon name. But I did it on the basis of having played the earlier Ultimas, right? I could say, oh yeah, I did those and I beat that one, you know, all of that. One of the first tasks. Yeah, one of the first tasks we had when we got to Origin was we had to play all of the older Ultimas to ramp up on Ultima history. So I read the Ultima novels, like Forge of Virtue or whatever.
Yep, the two Lynn Abbey books.
That's right. I read all of the hint books.
Some of which Dr. Cat wrote.
Yep. I got a hold of copies of all of the games, you know, and, you know, that meant we had to figure out, I mean, even by then, the computers at Origin were Win95, I guess, right?
So you had to figure out how to make Ultima 7 actually run?
That's right.
Oh,
and we had, Andrew had been co-lead on, Andrew Morris, had been, he was my boss, right? He had been co-lead on Ultima 8, right? On Pagan. So we went through and played each of them. Not to completion, but long enough to learn how they functioned, how they worked, got a hold of the complete plots, read everything, right? We didn't have enough time to sit and beat them all because it was research. So, yeah, we didn't have, other than Andrew, we didn't have the insanely in-depth knowledge of Ultima that, you know, certainly many of the dragons did. But at the same time, I've also always felt that there wasn't quite enough credit given to the amount of effort we put into Ultima Ness in setting up what UO was. The story of the sharding, right, by itself is drawn straight out of Ultima lore. The conflicts between our parallel universe and our parallel universe Lord British, right? For people who remember, who read the short stories that I used to write and post on the website. I don't know if any of you remember these. But when Virtue Guards went into the game, I wrote a short story to fictionally justify why they were in the game. And it was a conversation, a philosophical conflict between Blackthorn and LB.
And that story wound up in books in game, right?
Not all of it.
Okay.
Some of it.
I think I've only read the version that wound up in game. That's interesting. I thought it was really good. So
I wrote most of the books in the game, right? Most of the original origin authored books, Grammar of Orcish, and the at one point there was supposed to be a quest and a lost city of wind, and that's why several of the books reference a city of wind and reference there's like nursery rhymes and whatnot. There's the interconnecting story of Japheth the Paladin and the girl who was adopted by orcs, and that's when we were talking at one point of allowing orcs as player races. There were the stories written, the book by Sherry the Mouse. That story is where the background information on, hey, this is a shard, and a shard is a fragment, and the Guardian and the Time Lord are fighting over these shards and can turn them into Shadow Lords. Right. So we basically retconned the notion that Shadow Lords were fallen universes and that the Guardian could topple a shard and turn it dark and evil. Whereas the goal of Virtue, the mainline Ultimas, was to reintegrate these sharded universes back and restore the universe back into one universe instead of a shattered multiverse. And so that's what the Sherry the Mouse book is referencing. And it is the background conflict between Lord British and Blackthorn in Ultima Online. When LB is putting in systems like, I'm going to proclaim virtues now, which is ahistorical in the chronology, right? Because this is set, UO was set in advance of the arrival of the actual Avatar. He was the stranger in the first three. And UO is set right after Ultima 3. And the sharding happened back with Ultima 1, right? When Mondain was defeated. So the standalone games then are an Ultima universe that got an Avatar and the virtues happened. And that Lord British managed to make that shard virtuous. And that is what all the single player games have been doing. You have been playing retconned in. You have been playing in shards of that world that Mondain broke. But in Ultima Online, all of those shards, no Avatar ever visited. And the virtues weren't declared. So we had the Shrines of Virtues and LB set them up. And the Time Lord comes to him, and this is what is in the Sherry the Mouse book, and says, if you can get this shard to act virtuous and each individual shard to act virtuous, then maybe we can get them to resonate together and reintegrate back into one. And Lord British says, what about all of the people who have been born and live their lives since? They don't have duplicates. What happens when we reintegrate? They'll go away. And Blackthorn overhears this and says, I think I'd rather have diverse chaos over that. And that is why the two best friends in the Ultima Online series end up being friends but on opposing sides, at least until the Todd McFarlane abomination and cyborg whatever started happening.
Sure, but they, it was neat when Richard left, and so they took Lord British out of Ultima Online. The stories that got posted there were entirely the continuation of that story, where Lord British actually tries to perform the ritual.
Yes.
And winds up getting, you know, apotheosized out of the universe and moves on to Tabula Rasa.
Yes. It was always a huge frustration that because of team turnover, that thread of lore ended up getting lost and then rediscovered and then lost, right? I mean, that stuff was really frustrating. Because especially once I'd moved off, I was like, what are you doing? Where did this come from? Right. You know, I was like, where's this plot stuff coming from? Because there'd been all of this setup work done in order to set this stuff up. Lost Lands, Second Age. If you go find a map of, Ambrosia and the ending of Ultima 3, and you look at the area where you finally find Exodus after, you know, going through the whirlpool and coming out with your ship and landing in that Arctic region and going into the dungeon, that is the northern edge of Second Age Lost Lands. Lost Lands is literally based on the map from Ultima 3.
Oh, that's so cool.
And most people don't even know it or recognize it, but it is actually taken from that. Yeah, there were all of those threads that were in there. And some of the designers who came later knew it. So for a long time, Todd Bailey, GM Toad, he did know all of that stuff. And the plots that he wrote fit. And then later, he actually worked with me on Galaxies. And when none of the folks were around, some of that stuff got lost. And you started getting weird stuff. To my mind, weird stuff. But I actually think if people go and read the books that are built into the game and find Stratix, if you Google for it, you can still find like the end of beta story. The end of the UO beta is the story of the beta shard falling. So canonically in the Ultima universe, there are now four Shadow Lords because the beta shard is a Shadow Lord now.
It's unfortunate that Ultima 9 made it the decisions that it did about the Guardian's nature that makes it kind of incompatible with this set of story.
Well, yeah. There was not much lore communication going across there.
But
that's why it's a multiverse. That's why we can get away with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, because the end of beta, not only did we posted up again short stories. This was how we did it back then, is I would write short stories to justify major game shifting patches and to justify events, right? So we started out with a riddle and we ran this large scale in-game riddle game where we dropped notes and people had to assemble a poem out of these little snippets. And the poem gave riddles and announced the appearance of these crystals that started crashing onto the ground, right? The crystals were rare spawn and everybody started gathering these and murdering each other for them. And that was intentional. We wanted people to murder each other for them so that we could say, look, the shard is now turning evil. So then we published a short story about the shard turning evil. And, Nystol and Chuckles, LB and Blackthorn and so on, then tried opening a gate in order to try to find the source of these, and that let the Guardian in and attacked and wounded several of them, right? And may have actually slain Nystol. Chuckles ended up wounded but recovered, and LB ended up gravely wounded with a boil on his chest. And then Blackthorn started a new quest to gather the necromantic reagents because, you know, there would be a ritual or something that would heal that boil off of LB. And then we actually spawned those reagents and there was a giant end of beta quest, but we left one of the reagents out on purpose. We made it so that the quest could not be completed. We had already decided that LB would die. So we made it impossible to find all of the reagents. And the players are scrambling around trying to find them all. Then we posted another short story where Richard is in recovery. And Chuckles, who has been possessed by the Guardian, throws him over the balcony and he dies. And we posted that short story and also ran an in-game event. And using the in-game announce feature, we had GMs playing the parts and ran it like it was a play, you know, a piece of theater that was run on the announce channel. So every player in the game could see it as the Guardian came into the world, coming through because Chuckles opened the gate back open again. Lord British was dead. He came in. He killed Blackthorn, who died with a big "ah" on screen. And then he said, "This shard is now mine. A new Shadow Lord is aborning. And now I get to destroy all of you." And that is when we spawned umpteen billion demons. And for the end of the beta, we had a blast killing all the players who'd driven us nuts. That was the end of the beta shard. And you can still find those stories and the script and the play and everything on the old archives of Stratix.
Now, you mentioned something that actually I had already ticked in my mind to ask about: the ongoing rumors of necromancy.
It was planned and cut for time.
I remember.
That's it.
Was it Second Age or was it the expansion after that where the necromantic reagents were re-added to the world?
It was after Second Age. After Second Age. It was, I'm not even sure if it was. Shadows. Yeah, Age of Shadows. So it was actually even after Renaissance.
Yeah, that was the fourth one, right?
Yeah. And I was off by Renaissance. That were
grabbing reagents, sure that necromancy was finally going to get added there. And then when it didn't happen, there was a great deal of disillusionment. Until it finally showed up with the paladin stuff later.
Yeah, it was literally a time thing. We had it in our original design, managed to do it. To just touch briefly on, you know, the gap between mainline Ultima, there's even a design document circulated around the team that I wrote that basically says, and I think I've posted it on my website at some point, that basically says, the earlier Ultima games were an escalating course in ethics. You started out in the first three where it was like, oh yeah, we're going to do the standard, let's go defeat the evil. By Ultima 4, it was defeating evil isn't about being killing the evil thing. It's about you being good. Ultima 5 started being about, you know, by 5 and 6, it was maybe there's more than one way to be good, right? I mean, that's basically the lessons that you get out of 5 and 6, you know, with and 7 for that matter, with the gargoyles. You start learning about the, you know, if you set up an ethical system, you have to consider the validity of alternate ethical systems.
Right.
And that's the gargoyle story. You have to consider the risks of fundamentalism, which is actually the Blackthorn storyline, right? You know, of an overly rigid ethical. So it's essentially a gradually more complex way of looking at ethics. The document for Ultima Online said, that's what our history is. If we go and put in a points-based virtue system, then it's just going to get min-maxed. And we aren't going to have the storyline and the subtlety that the standalone game does. So it's just going to be just like one of the rep systems. A perfectly evil griefer player is going to walk around with avatar over his head because he's picked up all of the right quest objects or something. And it's not going to be reflective of who they actually are. And the document outright said, what that means is that Ultima Online has to be the virtues without the training wheels anymore. The game systems themselves have to encourage people to behave virtuously, for real, actually behave virtuously towards other players. It can't just be some system where you tick some boxes, because there are other people in the game now, and if you do that, it's going to be fake. And that meant that you owe, you know, kind of the next step on the ladder. It was now, can you do the virtues when you actually have free will? And that turned out to be a test that not only did most players flunk, but so did we as a dev team, in that we were not able to build the system such that they rewarded being a good person enough. Instead, the game actually ended up rewarding people disproportionately for being bad. It was very, very hard to be a true hero in UO. It was exhausting. All your victories were temporary. You could found a town and build a society and build a culture and protect it against, you know, the ravagers and rapists of civilization. And the problem was they could just make a new character and come back the next day. They were inexhaustible and you weren't. But that's why, to me, the shining moments of UO are still things like the Naked Army, the Anti-PKs, Cazola's Tavern, Pax Lair, the Golden Brew Players, you know, all of those things from early on, even Shadow Clan, where people decided to build rather than destroy and to, you know, in a sense, actually be the good people. And that is why I didn't want to put in a PK switch. That is why I didn't want Safe Zone, because to me, that would have been a betrayal of the actual core Ultima-ness of Ultima Online.
I will tell you that even after Trammell appeared, I stayed in Felucca, although I abhor PvP. And even though I was hunted down almost daily and killed by poopy diapers, I still stayed there anyway.
Yeah, I consider it a fail on my part that we never found a solution to that. One of the people who did was Jeff Freeman, aka Dundee, who ran a gray shard that made it so that if you player killed, so people could affiliate with a town, including a player town. And if you player killed somebody from that town, it blocked your access to those town's resources, meaning their shops, their, you know, whatever. You couldn't go in there anymore. I think the guards would actually attack you if you were a criminal to that town. And it meant that if you behaved antisocially, you gradually lost access to most of the game and ended up living out your life as an outlaw in the forest with no access to healing and skill training and, you know, ended up learning the error of your ways. So he actually found a way to do that. And he and I had had endless discussions and arguments on Usenet and on MudDev about player killing. When he started out his first shard, it was a Trammell style shard. He didn't have player killing. And then he wrote to me and he said, okay, you were right. The game is broken. This shard sucks. It's boring. So I'm going to try to solve this. Sorry?
Say again? The shard still exists.
I think the second one does, not his first one. Because in the second one
still exists.
Does it? I think that's awesome. Because he ended up making the second one that wasn't 100% safe and had things like that town system and all of that kind of thing. And he wrote to me to tell me about it. And by that time I was on Galaxies. And, you know, I was thrilled, right? I was like, you figured out a solution to this problem. I think that one was the one called Acadia.
Yes, I remember that name now as soon as you say it.
And he said, yeah, so I figured out something to do that solved this problem. I had been giving him advice, like even on the first one, he wrote to me and said, I don't have player killing, but players are still being jerks to one another. What do I do? And so in email, I used to send him things like advice on codes of conduct, policies for admins, how to set up, you know, a GM staff, all of that kind of thing. So I was sending him advice on how to run his shard all the time. We had this email relationship. And then when he told me about Acadia, he said, so what are you up to these days? And I said, send me your resume and I'll be able to tell you, because then I can put you under NDA. And that is how he ended up working on Star Wars Galaxies and creating the pet system for Star Wars Galaxies.
Dundee is the one, when I first started playing around with POL just as a user, and it had the script system with a scripting language that was also called eScript, and I do not know if that was a deliberate...
Almost certainly not.
but it was Eric Swanson, Syzygy, who had... basically, he had created eScript for as a school project, I think, kind of based on the structure of Pascal. And so it was the first really scriptable one. And Dundee was working on Acadia at the time. And so, you know, it had so many of the systems were handled in scripts instead of in the one executable, like EOX or whatever or the early, really early ones were. And... I was playing around and something just kind of annoyed me and bugged me that it wasn't working the way I thought it should. And Dundee encouraged me to rewrite it. And so I went in and I rewrote the doors system for so that because I think what annoyed me was that double doors didn't both open if you only clicked on one.
Yeah.
And so I fixed that for POL. And that eventually led to me being on the team for that. And Dundee was the one who gave me the initial push to do that.
Yeah, he was a huge part of the UOP. The day that I heard he died, it was one of the worst days. Because he was the guy that I had felt like we'd argue. He was older than I was. And we had argued and debated, and it felt like I had managed to, you know, in a way, mentor him in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was the guy who tried it the other way, came around, went on and did stuff like the pet system. Like he got it, you know. We had gotten in sync. He understood kind of the philosophies behind doing sandbox and doing all of the player driven stuff. In a way that, candidly, most of the people that I've worked with, I often have the problem. I don't consider myself a very good one-on-one mentor. When I heard we'd lost him, it was a really, really terrible day.
Yeah. Yeah, he
now had... I'm all choked up.
Yeah, I kind of don't want to end on that. He actually, after he started working on Star Wars Galaxies and so left the POL scene, he had sent me an email saying, hey, send me a resume.
Yep.
And then he sent me some questions that he wanted me to fill out answers for. And then I kind of took my sweet time answering them. And in the meantime, some big studio in Austin had gone bust. And he was like, yeah, we basically have everybody we possibly could want right here. So.
Oh, darn it.
I don't know that moving to Austin would have been a thing that I would have done at that point in my life. I had only fairly recently moved to California, but, you know, I was very flattered that he had thought to reach out and say hi again after he'd, you know, left the scene and gone on and be a professional and do it for real.
Yeah, the thing is, you know, to turn this around to something positive, and maybe it is a good ending note, that in the end, if you sit down and you think about the number of players of UO who ended up getting into the industry because they saw what that game, you know, I mean, just think about some of the stories we've told tonight, right? There are stories from UO that when you tell them to a gamer today, they literally answer with, holy shit, I cannot believe there was ever a game where that kind of thing could happen, right? And when you tell them, yeah, it was made 20 years ago, They go, what happened in the meantime? Why don't we have that, right? I mean, you know, yeah. Skyrim is the closest that we've got, right? You know, when you look back at that and the number of people that it ended up touching and lives it ended up changing, people who got into the industry and went off to make other things, players who ended up running their own worlds and having those, people who ended up getting into the industry, the number of people who worked on UO over the years is way into three figures. And they've gone on to end up touching just an enormous amount of the game industry. And, you know, even though a lot of people say, well, you know, UO and then later Galaxies and that's it for sandboxes other than Eve, what happened? I go, no. RuneScape was a UO clone. And RuneScape reached millions of kids. And, you know, Minecraft is partly because of Worm Online. You know, Notch worked on Worm. And guess what? Worm was inspired by UO. And, you know, a game where you can farm and games where you can do all this crafting. Gosh, you know, that wasn't a thing, right? It just wasn't something that people did in a video game. I think the influences of UO and the number of lives it touched and the number of people it ended up shaping are actually really enormous. And, you know, probably to a degree that it's not even possible to ascertain. So, yeah, I think even though we were a bunch of insane kids doing a bunch of insane stuff, lucky enough to be handed a budget that kids really shouldn't have been allowed to play with. you know, it made a mark that things still aren't trying to be it, but it basically was the first draft of a particular dream of what a game can be. And I don't think that dream goes away. I think people still want that game, that dream, even though what it ended up being isn't, you know, is like the rough draft that couldn't ever quite be fulfilled. So I think that's its legacy, is that dream is still out there. Anytime you see, you know, when you watch it was a dream born out of watching a Star Trek holodeck. It was a dream born out of reading Snow Crash, right? Those things there.
Absolutely.
And I think that its legacy ultimately is going to be that.
And I think that you're right, that is, I think we have perhaps kept you from your dinner for long enough.
It's only been here for 3 hours.
Love to hear more stories, but you know what? This podcast records more than once. If you come up with more stories sometime, withstand the fury to set aside another recording for it.
I have hundreds more stories like this. Easy.
To the listeners, make sure if you found this interesting, go read Raph Koster just recently posted to his blog an article about the 20th anniversary and some of the things that were said here as far as Minecraft, et cetera, being descended from. It's a good read. I will encourage Withstand the Fury to put a link in the show notes. Designer Dragon, if you mentioned a couple of times design documents and such that you think you may still have and have at some point in the past posted to your blog. If you dig any of those up and want to send them to the Ultima Codex, he would be thrilled to host some of them if he's not already.
Yeah, these are those things are mostly on my blog, on my website, particularly if you go into there's a whole section that isn't the blog under the game design heading that plays and presentations and interviews. And there's stuff, particularly in the snippets section, that are discussions about a lot of this stuff. including early stuff that was written during the time that we were designing UO. So some of these things are actually in there. So a lot of them are up on the website. It's probably too many links to put in the show notes. So I would just send people to rafcoster.com/games, because there's just a massive amount of stuff under there.
And if there's anything under there that seems particularly worth mirroring on the codex, I'm stuck on a couch for the next couple of weeks. Maybe I'll crawl through and see if there's anything. It'll be a blast from the past for me to look through that stuff anyway. So I'll add that to the list of things to do when I'm bored and I'm not playing Persona 5.
At some point, for historical purposes, I should go through. The way I work as a designer is generally on an artist's sketch pad, although these days I use my iPad. I have kept every sketchbook from UO forward. So I have the sketches where I'm designing the icons for the macro system and galaxies. I have the sketches where I designed how embankment and 3D textures work in UO. I have the original maps of Britannia. I have the sketches for how do arches fit together. I have all of that. And at some point I should scan those sketchbooks.
That would be fantastic if you ever found the time for that. I'm sure that you're busy.
It's funny because I'd even need to edit them. They have, you know, there's
how many of them are you swearing about stuff?
They have things like, oh, now let's have a Leeds meeting. I'll have my Leeds meeting notes scribbled in the corner and also pick up milk and here's the phone number and I need to go to the pharmacy and I met this person and I need to redact their name and phone number. So there's actually all that kind of random stuff in there. But yeah, I still have all of it except, and this is the big thing, the thing that has been lost to history. When the UO lawsuit happened, not the counselor lawsuit, but the class action lawsuit over the game being laggy and not available 24/7.
Right.
I had to send all of the design docs and patch notes to the legal department at EA. It was a stack of paper 6 feet tall. And it never came back.
Oh, man.
Who knows where it is? If anywhere, it's probably in a filing cabinet.
Yeah.
But
if it didn't wind up on the UO fire.
No, it did not, because it never came back to Origin. But I don't think that we ended up able to even keep copies of quite a lot of that stuff. Every patch note, every, like, you know, all, anything that was a quote design document was in that stack.
Well, I'm sure anything that you found that was not lost from that would be a fantastic thing to have as part of gaming history.
Absolutely.
But, yep. You know, no pressure.
All right. Well, my cold burger is now calling me. So,
thank you so much for coming out here.
Thank you.
This was my pleasure. This was a lot of fun. It was a good trip down memory lane, bringing back all these memories and feels. So,
yes, and it was also for me a pleasure to finally get to actually talk to you, having interacted very obliquely over the last 20 years.
Yep. Awesome.
I don't know if it's just me, but I think you speak faster in Spanish than you do in English.
No tengo la oportunidad de hablar en español.
2007 fue hace 10 años.
Uh-huh.
¿O en qué año fue?
¿Qué año fue qué?
Excelente charla en el Congreso, en la Universidad Autónoma de Baja California.
Ah, sí, en Ensenada. Sí. Sí. Más recientemente en Argentina y en el. Tuve la oportunidad de dar charlas ahí. For everybody else, we're talking about how rarely I Spanish, but that I've done talks in Spanish in Mexico, Peru, and Argentina. But I don't get the chance to talk about it much, or to talk in Spanish very much. Most people don't even know that I am half Latino. It's nobody associates that with me.
Well, the as Kenneth is not here to do his standard outros, he customarily asks people to let the listeners know where they can be found online. So, Raph, if you would like to repeat the URL for your blog and anything else that you would like to, perhaps your Twitter handle.
Sure. My Twitter handle is Raph Koster, R-A-P-H-K-O-S-T-E-R. My blog is also raphkoster.com. And you can also find me Tumblr feeds from my blog as well, if you're a Tumblr person. So, yeah, you can find pretty much everything I've ever written or presented goes up on there. It's like a million words of content. So you could be reading quite a long time.
Indeed. Draxanath, where can we find you?
You can find me on Steam and also on Facebook. I have a page for my project, Chronicles of the Dragon Goddess.
Fantastic. Revelox, where can we find you? Are you still here?
Yes, sir. I can be found. I can be found on Twitter as Revelox. I can be found in UO as Revelox. I could also be found in Shroud of the Avatar as Revelox.
Okay. Sir Klaus, is this your first time here?
I was on for the RPG vocal chat with Lynn Furry.
Well, where can you be found online? Listeners who might want to see more of what you have to say.
I'm online mostly on Twitter, but I don't say much. I'm mostly lurking for accounts on every good information I can get. And it's at P, and after that it's my name. So it's a bit complicated, so I'll leave it in chat. It's better.
Okay, well, hopefully that'll wind up in the show notes. I don't want to commit Kenneth to necessarily getting everything that I have said needs to be in the show notes into the show notes, but hopefully that'll be there. As for me, you can find me primarily tapestryofages.com and Dark Unknown Game on Facebook are the main places for my game, The Dark Unknown, which is, of course, not done. And Twitter as at Tapestry of Ages. So that's... Vanzilar, unfortunately, may or may not still be lurking, but doesn't have a microphone. So once again, Designer Dragon, Raph, thank you for coming out. Everybody, thank you for participating. Thank you to Kenneth for setting this up again. It's good that he has a little bit more time again after adding to the household. And as always, be virtuous. And that'll be where he cuts.
Awesome.
So, Raph, before you go, I just want to say the for me, Ultima is like, well, it's like Doctor Who. It's the one that you grew up with, right? The first one that you played. That's why Ultima 3 is my favorite.
Sure. It's the one that I beat. So for me, so many of my memories of Ultima end up being 3 rather than, the ones that for other people, I think most people end up saying 4 or 7, I think.
Right,
Or Serpent Isle.
I mean, compared to 3, I found 4 to have so much more, requirements.
You mean like not slaughtering all of the clerics in you?
Exactly, right. Yeah, what is it, following rules and stuff? Oh, man. But, I mean, seriously, it's like, I got into Ultima 3, and it just became part of my life. It's like I played it for 6 months, not even trying to beat the game. Just going around and doing maintenance every day, and eventually went over and beat up Exodus. But it was definitely something that changed my life. But then UO is just completely different thing. And with regards to UO, that game taught my youngest how to type. he wanted to play the game, but he didn't know how to use the keyboard or anything. So we put him in front of the computer and said, fine, you want to play the game? Because he was really young. He was like 8. And I was like, all right, fine, here, go ahead. You know, go for it. And yeah, he learned how to type. And then his older brother actually started becoming a trade master and made a fortune in that game. And
you know, that's the thing. So many stories like moments when people on the UO team figured out what kinds of things were going on were things like wandering around the game and stumbling across a family that would meet in the game to have dinner together because the father was stationed overseas.
Oh, that's
cool. Right. And so the kids and the mother would set up dinner on a table in the player house and they would meet that way. The stories that we got from people who were disabled, there was a contest early on at one point about send in your best UO story and you win a prize. You know, it was run by one of the fan sites. I think we supplied prizes. And the winning one came from somebody in a wheelchair, and it was really short. It just said, I love UO because there I can run. And that's the thing, is that I think that philosophical difference there about, hey, we're making a... And, hey, we're thinking in terms of, you know, everybody else was, you know, like the competition was like, yeah, we want to make, you know, well, EverQuest is a game, right? WoW is a game. And in UO, we were not thinking that way. We were thinking metaverse, future of the internet, all of that kind of crazy, you know, well, crazy stuff.
No, I mean, that's why Origin was, we create worlds, not games.
Yeah, but even more than that, but even more so in that we were thinking about things like, what does this mean for moderation systems of the future? What does this mean for, that's why things like the player rights, you know, avatar rights document got written, right?
Right.
Because we weren't thinking. I would go to GDC and I remember getting into debates with other designers where, you know, I would say, well, I'm not actually sure that we make games, us MMO people. I think, you know, we make things that can have games in them, but that isn't actually what we make. What we do is something bigger and more and harder. It's just kind of a different starting point in a whole bunch of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. No, definitely.
But I'm going to head off because I haven't had dinner yet either.
All right.
So I'm going to go hobble my way downstairs.
To zap this bowl of chili.
Probably. Enjoy your dinner now that we're finally letting you have it. Thanks for hanging out all that extra time.
Sure thing.
Those stories were really fantastic to hear.
Awesome. Maybe I'll come back sometime.
That would be... You've got a log in here now. Come on by anytime.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Great.
Yay.
All right. Talk later.
Have a nice night.
Bye-bye.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.